Is it about the man or the nation? Reactions to last Thursday's indictment by the International Criminal Court of Benjamin Netanyahu proved a measure of how much Israel and its longest-serving leader have perhaps squandered sympathy since the Hamas-led October 7th attacks on innocent civilians. We'll ask about the merits of the war crimes case and the reactions with a prime minister who's doubled down on rivals both abroad and at home, where he's already on trial for corruption and faces a fresh storm over leaked or doctored intelligence allegedly designed to shift blame over those 101 hostages still unaccounted for in Gaza. We'll count support and see if it's about one man or a nation that has drifted further right as it prepares for the second coming of a supportive Donald Trump to the White House. Can Israel go back to the pre-October 7th plan and the days of the Abraham Accords that, well, ignored the plight of Palestinians, instead favoring normalization with regional players? Today in the France 24 debate, we're talking about an Israeli prime minister who's taking on all comers. With us from Jerusalem, international criminal attorney Yael Viask-Wiersman. She represents victims of the October 7th attacks and is the founding director of the International Criminal and Humanitarian Law Clinic at Reichman University. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Sharon Vale is Associate Professor of International Law at the American University of Paris, also professor at Sciences Po, the French Political Science Institute. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Rina Bassist is International Correspondent for the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation, contributor to the news site Al Monitor's Israel Pulse website. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for reminding me.
And from Brussels, former British diplomat Nicholas Westcott, Research Associate at the Center for International Studies and Diplomacy of SOAS University, London. Good to see you.
Good evening.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24 debate. When news broke last Thursday of an International Criminal Court arrest warrant on suspicion of crimes against humanity and war crimes alongside his former defense minister, along with a top Hamas operative, Benjamin Netanyahu's response was strong and swift.
The anti-Semitic decision of the International Court in The Hague is a modern Dreyfus trial, and it will end the same way. 130 years ago, the French Jewish officer Alfred Dreyfus was falsely accused of treason by a biased French court. In response to these false accusations, the great French writer Émile Zola wrote his monumental essay, J'accuse. He accused the French court of anti-Semitic lies against an innocent officer who was later exonerated of all guilt. Now an international court in The Hague, also headed by a French judge, is repeating this outrageous offense.
Yael Viask-Wiersman, what was your reaction to Netanyahu's reaction, first of all?
I'd like to first emphasize that it is true that it's understandable to focus on two arrest warrants against the heads of state of a democratic state that is in war, that is not a state party to the Rome Statute. That is understandable. Yet, alongside this, there's a very important arrest warrant recognizing Hamas attack, recognizing extermination, rape, and sexual acts committed during the Hamas attack. And that, first of all, was a great achievement for the victims of an attack. Lives have been shattered since that day and are still shattered today with still in kept in Gaza. The reaction to this reaction, Emile Zola, Prime Minister, it can't be denied two things. One, the arrest warrants are received with great shock among Israeli society because this is the nation's most difficult hour. It's the nation's most challenging hour. There are concerns about devastation and bloodshed throughout, including, of course, in Gaza. But this comes at a shock. The shock comes from the apparent of framing the actions of the Israeli Defense Force with the same go as the acts of an extremist fundamentalist Islamic movement that are there to exterminate Israel, the ICC, they're there to exterminate, let's say. That's what the ICC arrest warrant against Mohammed Daif recognized. And of course, the Israel's army is made of civilians who go to the army, a reservist, 300,000 reservists, along with around 100,000 duty soldiers. They do not send their children and their daughters and sons in order to commit, in order to commit international crimes. And this ethos is important to Israeli society, despite the fact that Israel society today, as anyone can see on the streets, is divided on very difficult dilemmas that it is dealing with.
Nicholas Westcott, do you agree that there was a false equivalency in the charge that came out of The Hague?
There are very different factors here. Firstly, Hamas launched the attack in the first place and committed those atrocities. And the court in The Hague recognizes that. But secondly, they are asking whether Israel's response to that, its self-defense, is proportionate, or whether it has actually been submitting civilians in Gaza to unfair and actions that are against international humanitarian law. And they're saying there is prima facie a case that the Israeli army, the military, have been going beyond the strict needs of defense in their actions against Palestinian civilians in Gaza.
And as a result, and I'll put it to you, Sharon Vale, your students, how do they feel about this? Because you have, again, this question of whether or not, there's the right to defend, and then there's been this steady diet of images that we have seen over the last 13 months coming out of Gaza, and the fact that it looks to a lot of people like ethnic cleansing.
So I would like to come back to the first question that you were raising, whether it's a person or it's a nation, and, this framing. And I think it's about politics and actions. I mean, it's about what this government has been doing. And I don't think that we should put in one block Israel, because since this arrest warrant, I've heard a lot of Israeli, which are not necessarily pro-Palestinian or whatever you will tell them, that will say, oh, it will be good if they will arrest him, in the sense that we've seen a transformation of Israel. It's a slow process, but it's a long process where we've seen that democracy is starting to fade, let's say. We've seen a far-right government that is in place. We've seen that even during this combat in Gaza, we are reinforcing the settlements. We are reinforcing violence within the settlements. And this is important. And this is not necessarily what the Israeli people want. This is what the government is doing, headed by this prime minister. So perhaps the ICC is good news for Israel, who are for democracy. Perhaps it can reinforce these things that is starting to get completely loose in Israel.
But when the news broke, Rina Basis, people rallied behind their prime minister.
Yes, and I think that I can put a few elements on the table. First of all, it's true, there are a lot of people in Israel that are against the current politics of Mr. Netanyahu, that feel that the war must end, that we must arrive to a deal that would see the liberation of the hostages and a ceasefire in Gaza immediately. Having said that, I think still the majority of Israelis think that the ICC went too far, blaming Netanyahu of intentionally starving the Gazans. That's a first element. This is what I feel when I speak with the friends, with the colleagues in Israel. The second thing is the chronology of everything, and that's very important, because Mr. Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the ICC, could have chosen another way of proceeding. What could he have done? He could have, after the October 7, already 8 of October, because all the material was there to see. We know that the terrorists of Hamas. They filmed themselves. There was a lot of material also by the victims who also filmed themselves, who spoke with their relatives when they were escaping or trying to save themselves. There was a lot of material. Karim Khan could have started with the leaders of Hamas asking an investigation, asking to arrest the leaders of Hamas. And then later on, as time goes by, perhaps when the war ended, to start looking about the responsibility of the Israeli leadership and especially, of course, Mr. Netanyahu. He didn't do that. He decided to search for this equivalence between the two. And this is something I think that for many, many Israelis, it was too difficult to swallow. The fact that he asked at the same time last May to arrest both the leaders of Hamas, of a terrorist organization, and the leaders of Israel, which eventually is a democratic state, which has shown already in the past. You know, we had a president that was charged, indicted, and went to prison. We had the prime minister who was charged, indicted, and went to prison. So there is, even though this judicial system has been eroded under Netanyahu, that's obvious, but the judicial system exists. So I think these two elements made it that most of the opposition leaders, in fact, all of them, apart from the leader of the Arab party, Hamas, all of them stood by Netanyahu, even his opponents, when the ICC made the decision.
What is for sure is that a lot's happened in the 13-plus months since October the 7th. Roll the clock back here in France. The Eiffel Tower was lit up in blue and white, the blue and white of Israel's flag on the Monday that followed that Hamas-led attack. Since then, the world has watched on social media. There you saw those images from more than a year ago. Has watched every day on social media the leveling of the Gaza Strip, the displaced exposed to the elements, like this baker who spoke this Monday in the city of Khan Yunis.
We are scared, not knowing if we will live or die, and now on top of that, we've got the rain. I can't find a cover from it. My source of living is wide open. It was drowned in rain yesterday. Today, I'm also scared of the rain. I was worrying about life or death. Now we worry about the rain.
This steady diet of images and the fact that there seems to be no end to the war in Gaza. Yael Vyask Viersman, is that something that's talked about where you are?
You're referring about the end to war?
Yes, in Gaza.
It's definitely a topic that is every day on the street, a ceasefire. The necessity of war. There is no doubt that this was a war of necessity and not a war of choice. And this is why the majority of civilians are still going to reserve and so forth and still believe in the necessity, even though many of them, I have to say, on a Saturday night, they can demonstrate in the streets. And then on a Sunday morning, they will put back their uniform and go back to fight, because this is the most difficult, challenging hour of this nation, confronted not only with a southern front, but with six or seven different fronts of extremism since 7th of October. Hezbollah, Houthis, we wake up in the morning with a drone exploding, and only an hour later we know it's a drone from Iraq. I mean, the situation is it's gone to absurds. There is no denying the suffering of the Gazans. The question is, why do Hamas continue to choose this war every day? Why do they not drop their weapons? Why do they not cease with the crime against humanity, recognizing the arrest warrant on Thursday by the ICC of hostage taking? They have the choice and they have the obligation to unconditionally and immediately release these hostages back home, 101 individuals. I want to say something about the framing. On the 12th of August, as victim representative, we were asked by the court to file the views and concerns of the victims of Hamas attacks. And what we asked was, one, for justice to be done, for justice to be seen to be done. If any arrest warrants are founded, let them be issued. However, whatever you do, please, court, do it separately. Unlike the ICC prosecutor's statement in one breath, asking for five arrest warrants against in a totally different set of facts, totally different evidence based on different evidence. And this is what the court did. It issued two separate decisions, two separate press releases. We already see the effect. In substance, these arrest warrants are totally separate in, let's say, format. They're still too much linked together, which, in fact, de facto, is detrimental to the victims of Hamas attacks. Because, as an illustration, on the 20th of May, when ICC prosecutor Mr. Karim Khan declared that he was requesting five arrest warrants, I received 15 calls from journalists, both Israeli and international, and I was asked one question. What do you think of the arrest warrants requested against Prime Minister Netanyahu? And that is understandable, but I was thinking, if I am asked that question and nobody asks me, what do the victims think? What about the arrest warrants against Yahya Sinwar and the three heads of Hamas? Then who is asking this question? So where do these victims come in? And the situation is so politicized, ostensibly politicized, that we call for, you know, the highest place of diligence, highest sort of level of diligence in dealing with this, because these are lives of human beings that are affected by decisions accepted by the court. And, the pretrial chamber acted accordingly.
Nicholas Westcott, how's the conversation being framed in the UK, and how has the conversation evolved over these past 13 months?
It's been a very intense and interesting conversation, because a large part of the issues surrounds what is the role of international law. Is there such a thing as international law? Can it be effectively enforced? The ICC was set up in the first place to try individuals who could not otherwise be brought to justice. And where there is either not a national system working, or the government and the judicial system is controlled by the people who are accused of committing the crimes. There have been precedents for the ICC indicting heads of state or government. President Bashir in Sudan because of the accused of genocide in Darfur. Presidents Kenyatta and Ruto in Kenya. None of these have been particularly successful, and there are big questions over whether this is an effective way of trying to tackle these issues, because it is very difficult indicting a sitting head of state or government, as we're seeing in the reaction there is. Nevertheless, the British government has said very clearly, and I think has public support in this, that the international rule of law should apply to all parties. And other heads of government who are accused, including President Putin now, they should be held to account somehow if they are breaking international law.
Yes, but Nicholas, we've heard on that point, and we heard the UK Foreign Secretary this very Monday kind of make this argument. Yes, international law should be applied. We'll see how it is applied. So sort of this sort of caveat, and we've heard the same thing here in France, by the way, saying, we should respect the independence of the court, but we're not quite sure how we apply its order.
Look, that is an issue also amongst other member states of the European Union, most of whom have said, we will respect the ICC's indictment, we will apply the rule of law here. Only the Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban, has said, I won't recognize it. But all those are members of the ICC. Israel is not a member of the ICC. The US is not a member of the ICC. To some extent, they are not bound by that. But the court is saying these crimes took place in Palestine. The state of Palestine is a member of the ICC. So there is jurisdiction there. It needs to be that they are raising the question, there is some evidence to suggest we think this issue needs to be brought to trial to test the evidence. And their case is that, you know, there is clear evidence that Hamas, who also can't be brought to a national court because it doesn't exist in Gaza, have contravened international humanitarian law. But there is also evidence that Israel has gone above and beyond the right of self-defense to do that, and that should also be held to account.
Sharon Vale, you agree?
Thank you. So I wanted to follow up on what has been said about what next, right? What can happen? And I think that was interesting is that we have an arrest warrant against a person that is dead. So
it was presumed dead. It hasn't been.
Yeah, but I mean, presumed dead. Yeah, okay. It's like in France when we have the terror trial. There was a lot of the procès des fantômes, the ghost trial, because people were presumed to be dead.
Yeah, some
in
of the
Syria.
Defendants were.
Yes, and then, I mean, it's probably dead, right? And still, there is this arrest warrant. So I'm wondering if we could follow France's practice of justice and to think about trial in absentia. This could be very interesting because in France, for example, we have a trial against a Syrian high-level responsible for crimes of torture and crimes against humanity not long ago in May. And these were trials in absentia. So why is it interesting? Because then you will have the victim coming saying what they have, and then there is a possibility to establish facts, even if you don't have the accused. And I think that the idea to do trials in absentia for this kind of trials could be very interesting because we could create a forum where we will have victims from both sides that will come, that will narrate what happened to them, and we try to establish the fact and a common narrative. And this, I think, is important. And I don't say that it will happen tomorrow, but perhaps it is a way to go.
Very briefly on this, Yael Vyask-Viersman, you agree?
I'd say what we call a semi-transitional justice process within Israel, outside Israel, between Israelis and Palestinians is important. It's not really what we're talking about, right? Not really what is at question at the ICC and the arrest warrant. There is one case of absentia at the ICC of Joseph Kony, which is a precedent that opened recently. Mohammed Deif, even if he is dead, we will continue. The fact that there are arrest warrants against Hamas officials is part of the center of our work at October 7 Justice Without Borders, because we bring evidence directly to the investigators of the ICC. The ICC prosecutors have not been able to investigate Shurplas, so on Israeli soil, and we will continue to pursue. The importance is to remember even if Mohammed Deif, dead or alive, his connection to Hamas and the characterization by the court in an arrest warrant of the Hamas attack as extermination, torture, rape, and sexual acts. And inhumane and degrading treatment. This is really the important thing to remember.
That's on the one hand. On the other, there's, of course, as well, what Nicholas Westcott was talking about, Israel's right to defend itself, the court thinking that Israel had gone beyond that, and the Israeli government's proving touchy the last few days. It's now ordered all public entities to stop advertising in left-leaning newspaper Haaretz. This after its publisher recently gave a speech in London denouncing what he called an apartheid regime imposed on the Palestinian territories.
The Netanyahu government doesn't care about imposing a cruel apartheid regime on the Palestinian population. It dismisses the costs of both sides for defending the settlements while fighting the Palestinian freedom fighter that Israel calls terrorists.
And there's now been rushed through, it seems, this draft bill. I'll put it to you, Rina Bassist, to now pull all advertising from the government in Haaretz. They're also talking about privatizing your outfits, the state broadcaster in Israel. Are the two linked? What's it about in this case? And is that really such a problem when the publisher of Haaretz describes what he sees, labels it an apartheid state, what's going on in the Palestinian territories?
I'm not sure the two things are linked, even though, of course, this government has been attacking to a certain degree, freedom of the press. That's undeniable, I think. And there is a continuous effort by the government to close down or to shape that would be perhaps a better word, to shape the public broadcasting to fit the government's narrative. But I think what provoked this outcry of the government and also of many other people against Gershon Schocken was not so much his word about apartheid, but his words about the freedom fighters. And I think here he really crossed some sort of a line more than between the right and the left. All these relatives of the hostages, the relatives of the victims of October 7, I think this was something that was very difficult for them to hear, that Palestinians, even those who are part of members of Hamas, could be labeled as freedom fighters. And even people within Haaretz said, this is not us. We are not behind these words of Gershon Schocken. Of course, this is playing into the hands of the Netanyahu government. Each time something like that happens, such a provocative statement that maybe would have better not been said, this is playing exactly into the hands of Netanyahu, exactly into the hands of the communication minister that is trying to limit this freedom of the press, that has labeled already in the past Haaretz as some sort of a subversive outfit. So here it's some sort of a lose-lose situation, I think, for everybody.
The question's being raised about Israel's democracy right now outside the country. People are wondering. Every Saturday night in Israel, hostage families gather to demand that their loved ones become the top priority. On that score, Netanyahu has clashed openly with the head. These are the images from this past Saturday, with the head of the military, Herzi Halevi, who's warned it was becoming more difficult to get the return of the captives held in Gaza without a ceasefire deal. He and the head of the Shin Bet intelligence services, Ronan Barr, in the crosshairs, ever since it was exposed that a September story in a German newspaper Bild pointed to leaked in Israeli intelligence showing how late Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar was using the hostages to his advantage. The fallout has provoked a scandalous Kemi Knight report.
The ICC's warrant against Benjamin Netanyahu could significantly restrict his ability to travel. But even at home, Netanyahu is under legal pressure. One of his closest aides, Eli Feldstein, was indicted on Thursday as part of a scandal known as Bibi Leaks. He's charged with intending to harm national security and could be handed a life sentence if convicted. He's one of several aides and assistants close to Netanyahu who are being investigated over the stealing of classified documents that prosecutors say were tampered with before being handed over to foreign media in an attempt to thwart a hostage deal and boost Netanyahu's image. The Prime Minister isn't personally accused of wrongdoing in the case, but opposition leaders hold him responsible for the scheme. A case he is legally involved in, though, is the corruption trial that started in May of 2020. Netanyahu was indicted in 2019, and despite every effort to delay taking the stand, his testimony is now scheduled for the 2nd of December. He's always maintained his innocence.
You know how it will end. There will be nothing because there is nothing and there was nothing.
He's been indicted on charges of bribery, fraud and breach of trust. The trial was initially pushed back due to the COVID-19 pandemic and more recently because of the war in Gaza.
Netanyahu's been vocal. So has his son, Yair Netanyahu, repeatedly denouncing the leak investigation as, quote, a blood libel. This is an article from the Financial Times, calling the country's security chiefs a junta that are fomenting a coup against his father's government. Yael Viask-Wiersman, before October the 7th, there was that tussle over the judicial overhaul that the Netanyahu government had tried to put in place. What we're seeing here, is this just, you know, the rough and tumble of Israeli politics, or is democracy in danger?
We're seeing what for us as Israeli citizens is perhaps the most painful reality. It's true, we're facing enemies from all sides that wish to exterminate the state of Israel, that have never accepted its existence, although it exists under international law. However, the attacks from within are somehow felt more deeply. And, you know, having a country at war with internally displaced persons still homeless, hundreds and thousands since October 7, you know, so many wounded and so forth. And then to have the legislative branch, it's not Prime Minister Netanyahu alone, legislative branch led by ministers, of course, that are in government, having about 60 legal law proposals that have to do with what they call the continuance of the judicial reform, which is actually crushing of democracy, and as well as personal attacks against the state attorney, Gali Marab Biara, who is, of course, a symbol of democracy. It's the judiciary branch that has to be kept independent and so forth. Yes, it is a blow. It is a blow. However, we see that despite, again, the greatest tensions we've endured socially in Israeli society, again, when something is seen as unjust, unfair, and failing to the truth from the outside, like the ICC arrest warrant, then you know, everyone comes behind the flag or behind even Prime Minister Netanyahu, despite the fact that I believe that if there were elections today, he would not be elected. I want, with your permission, to say one thing about the framing of the arrest warrants that are there. Israel's right to defend itself, of course, does not justify any commission of any crimes, especially not international crimes. That's not the deal. It's not that a just war can be fought under any terms. No, Israel is obligated and has to alleviate suffering of civilian population as much as possible. That's its obligation under laws of armed conflict, under international humanitarian law, international criminal law, under customary international law. There is no doubt about that. The doubt, the big doubt, are the facts. The framing of the arrest warrants against Israeli heads of state did not have to do anything about ethnic cleansing or any such fact. The prosecutor, so ex parte, he's the only the prosecutor's narrative is before the judges at this stage of the procedure, arrest warrants, asked the judges to issue arrest warrants also for extermination. This was rejected by the court. What is under scrutiny is Israel's alleged humanitarian aid policy on the one hand, and whether it is attacking civilians intentionally, targeting civilians intentionally. All incidents were rejected by the court except for two incidents, which I believe that these two incidents can be tried and absolutely reviewed, judicial review, also for the citizens of Israel under the existing Israeli mechanisms, which are applauded and recognized around the world. In terms of the policy of starvation and so forth, that's a commission of inquiry. Mm. But they'll have to let the prosecutor in, because the prosecutor is the only one today that can withdraw the arrest warrant without a trial taking place.
And yet we have a situation right now, Sharon Vale, where the prosecutor is not being let into to Israel.
He's not
in Israel, Karim Khan.
Yeah, no, of course not. I mean, he was there. But, you know, I want a little bit to react about what was just being said. I mean, you know, it's one thing to speak about this narrative that Israel is being exterminated by its neighbor. And it's one thing to see what Israel is doing in Gaza. Because, I mean, there are facts and we need to look at the facts and to stop to speak under kind of propaganda of defending some ideologies. Because just like, let's look at the facts. I mean, you know, and if we're talking about over 44,000 dead people in Gaza, while I don't have the exact number, but a lot of civilian children and civilians and women and house destruction and people don't have what to eat and et cetera and et cetera. And then to say, oh, but, you know, why there is something against him and not him? I mean, you know, we are speaking about a very extreme situation of violence. And I think that the people in Israel should start looking not only about their pain, but also what is going on in the other side. Because maybe one day it will be a bit too late to wake up and to understand what is being done under their name.
Rina Basist, we've been told for the last 13 months that right now it's a period of war. And that once the war is over, what Sharon Vale is describing, maybe there'll be more people who will be trying to look for the common ground. But right now, People are in a moment where it's impossible because it's a state of war. But that state of war seems endless at this point.
It brings us exactly to what we spoke about before, about all these judicial challenges what the government is trying in eroding the freedom of the press, eroding also the responsibilities of the Supreme Court. We see since, I think, October 8, that Mr. Netanyahu is preparing his own narrative of what happened, preparing, in fact, for this commission of inquiry that we will have one day. Perhaps it will take some time. Perhaps it will be after the war ends. Perhaps we will have to have first new elections to have this commission of inquiry. But we will have this commission of inquiry. And over these last 13 or 14 months, Monsieur Netanyahu has been preparing for that. And all these efforts, all these moves are part of this preparation, I think.
Do you expect him to have to testify next week on December 2nd at his corruption trial?
Mr. Netanyahu or his lawyers have asked several times and received several delays for him to testify. I think that this time the court will say no. The court already said no once. I think they will say again a no. I think even the court understands that there is a limit. This trial cannot go on forever. The Israeli public also needs to know where we stand with our prime minister. So let's hope and see, but we will sure know in a day or two.
Nicholas Westcott, as we're speaking, there's trying to cobble together a U.S. brokered deal for a ceasefire with Lebanon, but with Israel. But your thoughts, because we are talking on the one hand about international law and on the other hand, the court of public opinion. What is Israel's future in that regard?
Well, I think you put your finger on the point that there is a big political question. Where does this all end? We've been talking about the role of international law. International law was sort of created and re-established firmly after the Second World War to try and prevent people taking actions as some countries had during the war, which against all humanitarian principles. So that's what it exists for. But we have to focus on where does this end? How do we re-establish peace in this region before even worse conflicts occur? There were long negotiations over months for a ceasefire in Gaza. And I think there is some blame on both sides for not having landed that ceasefire deal. It was possible at a number of points. We now hope that there will be a ceasefire deal in Lebanon. But again, Prime Minister Netanyahu is a master of the art of staying in power. And if a continued conflict helps him stay in power, then he is likely to continue supporting that. But there is no end to the war. So we have to look at how do we bring this conflict to an end? Will the ICC indictment help that by bringing people to realize that there is a very precarious situation here? Israel has always had one great strength in that it's a democracy. That's why attacks on the judiciary, attacks on free speech are worrying, because that is a democracy, enables the Israeli people to say, actually, we want to achieve a peaceful outcome, and that may be better by talking rather than just fighting endlessly. But they need to have that choice.
Nicholas, let me ask you on this, because our correspondent was telling us earlier how the imminent return of Donald Trump to the White House does not necessarily give Benjamin Netanyahu a free pass to have a forever war. Your thoughts on that?
There is a risk here that Israel's continued aggression, including trying to reduce the risk of threat from Iran, drags the US into another war in the Middle East. And Trump would be firmly opposed to that. But it's clear that the administration appointments announced so far are very pro-Israeli. And that has traditionally been Trump's position. And I think Netanyahu will see how far he can push the US to continue supporting him come what may. And he will want to find the point at which the US will finally say, no, we won't support you. He is keen to reduce the threat from Hezbollah, from the Houthis, as well as from Hamas, and particularly from Iran. But if his objective is regime change in Iran, that is going to exacerbate conflict. And I imagine even Donald Trump will pull back from that.
One of Donald Trump, by the way, his first appointments was ambassador to Israel. He picked former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. We can show you images from 2015 visiting a West Bank settlement, settlements that are in violation of international law. Benjamin Netanyahu, he doesn't have an election right away. He's got a friend in the White House, and he has a friend in the White House coming in, one who's already appointed, again, as ambassador, somebody who will please the far-right members of his coalition.
Yes, that's true. And we could see the euphoria within the Netanyahu government, within the settlement movement, of course, after the victory of Mr. Trump. I'm not so sure that they will get what they are hoping for. We have seen, first of all, we all know the very uncertain character. It's very difficult to say ahead what Mr. Trump will do or not do when he's really president. I think that's a secret for nobody. And then we also know that Mr. Trump, first of all, he sees himself as a deal maker. And to make a deal, this would not be the way to go. Because if he advances, if he recognizes the accepts the annexation of parts of the West Bank or any other such moves, of course, that will prevent any deal, either between Israel and the Palestinians or the big deal that both Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu are dreaming of, which is the normalization of ties between Israel and Saudi Arabia. That's not going to happen. So I, instead of the Israeli right and far right, would be very prudent about all this expression of happiness. And we'll see. We have also seen that under his former presidency, it was not, by the end of the day, it was not neither his ambassador to Israel nor his secretary of state that really shaped the foreign policy of Mr. Trump. It was his son-in-law. We don't have Mr. Jared Kushner in an official position this time around. So I think we will have to wait and see who really would be the person to influence Mr. Trump. Maybe to make him proposals that he would act on.
All right, we'll have to leave it there for now. Rina Bassist, I want to thank you so much. I want to thank, as well, Sharon Vail for being with us. Yael Vyas Gvirsman in Jerusalem. Nicholas Westcott in Brussels. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.
After the pandemic, we feel that increasing of the racism, increasing of this anti-immigrants propaganda and hates, and also the bigotry, increase a lot. The main concern is like a government painting the immigrant to be the cause of the problem, but we are not the cause of the problem. We are the solution of the problem. If the government invests more in economy, the immigrant will be the asset for this country.
For just under 2 years, the Canadian public has been bombarded by narratives that there are just too many people in the country and too many people coming into the country for the number of houses that we have and for the capacity of our healthcare system. And that slow drumbeat has, you know, finally hit home with the public.
Thanks very much for staying with us. Time now for Eye on Africa with me, Georgia Calvin-Smith.
All the latest in politics, economics and the arts in Africa on France 24. Our journalists are in every region, every country, to report on the emergence of a continent of unparalleled riches, bringing you Africa's stories on France 24.
Thanks for joining us. Do so again. Take care.
Liberté, égalité, actualité.